We pick up again our theological fork to take a third bite of the elephant of chapter 2 of Pope St. John Paul II's groundbreaking theology of the body. In sections 4 and 5, out of 7 total sections, the Pope feels the need to address important objections to Christ's teaching about adultery in Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 28. Right off the bat, John Paul acknowledges that Christ's words about adultery in the heart are demanding. Recall how we said the heart work is really the hard work. But he insists it should not, for that reason, be dismissed as impossible or irrelevant. I once heard a golf pro say that there are 100 ways to hit the golf ball wrong, but there is only one way to hit it right. Likewise, there are many ways to misunderstand Jesus' words about adultery in the heart, but there is only one way to understand it correctly, namely, what John Paul II proposes in the theology of the body. The Pope will identify 6 such ways to get adultery in the heart wrong, while defending the only way to get adultery in the heart right. In this way, the Pope Saint follows in the footsteps of one of his spiritual masters, Saint Thomas Aquinas. In Aquinas's masterpiece, the Summa Theologica, the angelic doctor first lists the objections to the truths of the faith, to give the devil his due. And then he proceeds to debunk them. John Paul II then, in sections 4 and 5, turns to meet such objections, or as we might say, his opponents. The first objection or opponent is his most formidable foe and rears his ugly head repeatedly throughout the theology of the body, namely, Manichaeism. The Pope explains, Manichaeism, which sprang up in the Orient from Mazdean dualism, that is outside the biblical sphere, saw the source of evil in matter, in the body, and therefore condemned all that is bodily in man. Have you heard of the modern phenomenon called cutting? Where teenagers have the habit of cutting their arms or their legs as a way of mitigating the deeper anxieties they feel. They punish the body as if it were the culprit for their problems. Cutting is one manifestation of Manichaeism, which sees the human body as the root of human evil. Today's teenagers practice cutting and blame the body, like modern-day Manichaeans, for their problems. But like the Jews erred in crucifying Jesus, teens too condemn the innocent body when they should be pointing an accusing finger at the guilty, namely concupiscence. Next, John Paul II considers 3 objections or 3 opponents together, kind of a trifecta of troublemakers. That is, the modern thinkers Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud. Each thinker reduces a person to one or another critical component of what it means to be human, but fails to see the whole picture of the person. Their predicament is like the Indian folklore of the 6 blind men who tried to learn what an elephant was. One touched the side and declared, "It is smooth and solid. The elephant is a wall." The second grabbed its limber trunk and said, "An elephant is a giant snake." The third touched its pointed tusk and exclaimed, "An elephant is a deadly pointed spear." The fourth felt the elephant's leg and decided, "We have here an extremely large cow." The fifth found its large ear and determined, "An elephant is a huge fan, or maybe a flying carpet." And the sixth touched the tail and pronounced, "Why, this is nothing than an old piece of rope." In other words, like so many modern philosophies, Nietzsche, Marx, and Freud missed the forest for the trees. The Holy Father translates the thinking of this trifecta back into biblical terms. In Nietzschean hermeneutics, the judgment and the accusation of the human heart corresponds in some way to what the biblical language calls the pride of life. In Marxist hermeneutics, to what is called concupiscence of the eyes. In the Freudian hermeneutics, by contrast, to what it calls concupiscence of the flesh. Put simply, one man sees people only in terms of power. The second sees man as he deals with money or material goods. And the third only concerns himself with human sexuality. There is, to be sure, some truth in each philosophical system. But that also turns out to be the critical problem. There is only some truth, but they think it is the whole truth. The theology of the body, by contrast, presents the whole truth about who a human person is in a panoramic perspective that leaves out nothing. The theology of the body comprehends the whole elephant from trunk to tail. The fifth objection the Pope confronts is eros, or the erotic. In modern usage, we associate the erotic with only what is both sexual and shameful, euphemistically called adult entertainment. That's erotic. But John Paul wants to rescue eros and recover its more ancient meaning that is quite sublime and even hints at the holy. He explains, according to Plato, eros represents the inner power that draws man to all that is good, true, and beautiful. The Pope is concerned that we not dismiss all sexual desire as, on the one hand, disordered and evil, like the Manichaeans did, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, nor, on the other hand, glorify and exaggerate its value, like Freud did. Rather, like in the case of the body being basically good, so man's deepest impulses, especially his strong sexual desire for the opposite sex, is fundamentally good, as long as it is not tainted with concupiscence. John Paul insists, further, if the words of Matthew 5, verses 27 through 28 represent such a call to the true, good, and beautiful, then this means in the erotic sphere, eros and ethos do not diverge, are not opposed to each other, but are called to meet in the human heart and to bear fruit in this meeting. It's hard to miss the conjugal connotations the Pope implies in that statement. That is, the ethical and the erotic are called to become one in the heart, like a husband and wife become one on their honeymoon, and thus both couples bear fruit. I will let you decide which spouse symbolizes eros and which one ethos. The sixth opposition the Holy Father faces is called the problem of erotic spontaneity. The Pope puts the problem succinctly. People often maintain that ethos takes away from spontaneity, from what is erotic in human life and behavior. And for this reason, they often demand detachment from ethos for the benefit of eros. Again, he showed with the shallow and one-sided understanding of the body, and also with eros, so he will demonstrate in the case of spontaneity. The Pope will maintain that such objections are mistaken and superficial. It may help to compare the truly spontaneous man and the only apparently spontaneous person with someone who can have two or three alcoholic drinks versus the alcoholic who has no self-control. The alcoholic may claim to be more spontaneous when he drinks himself under the table. But such spontaneity is a farce and fools no one who is sober. The Pope points to a more mature spontaneity, arguing, at the price of mastery over these impulses, man reaches that deeper and more mature spontaneity with which his heart, by mastering these impulses, rediscovers the spiritual beauty of the sign constituted by the human body in its masculinity and femininity. What is truly at stake in the question of sexual spontaneity is who acts freely and who is simply a slave to his passions. A slave cannot be spontaneous because he is shackled to his sins. John Paul writes, in addition, he gradually experiences the freedom of the gift. In the final riveting scene from the movie Flight, Denzel Washington plays an alcoholic pilot who had his license revoked and was sentenced to prison for crash landing a plane. Seated before other inmates in prison, Captain Whitaker humbly acknowledges this: "But at least I am sober. I thank God for that. I am grateful for that." And this is going to sound really stupid, coming from a man locked up in prison. But for the first time in my life, I am free. That glorious freedom from slavery, in all its forms, especially concupiscence, is precisely the hope of the theology of the body. Praised be Jesus Christ.